for us, unschooling completely means letting go of the system and completely letting go of it.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
My name is Michelle, and I go through this revolution by the name of Oracle, meaning speaker of wise things, so I remain quiet most of the time. I'm a mother of three. I'm 30 years old now. I've been through the system. I'm a product of it, and I have decided to do something different in this silent revolution, and it starts with the individual, which is myself, and then it extends on to my family, and I'm very grateful to be aware of these things and to actually try to make a real change in the world.
So how did you come to the whole idea of not sending your kids to school?
It was a process. It was a very big process, and it started with religion and my searches for myself in terms of what I was looking for, trying to find inner peace, trying to make real changes in my own life. And then it led me to exploring unassisted childbirth, which was like delivering my own children at home. And then from there, I thought, well, if I could do this, why can't I school them myself? And so that whole avenue opened up, and I started to explore it. I started to look into structured curriculums and so on and so forth. And it just didn't suit my lifestyle or how we lived. And so I came into the unschooling situation just open-armed. So I did grow up here. I started right at JK, which is junior kindergarten, in the Toronto School Board system. And I was, at the time, it was maybe 1976 or so, in my neighborhood in Scarborough, I think it was three of us who were minority students. One was Indian, one was from Jamaica, and then myself, who is of mixed parentage from Trinidad. The three of us in the entire school were the only ones of color, and maybe two Chinese students at the time. And it went on like that all the way up till about sixth grade, because it was a K-6 school, and there were a few other students who started to join in throughout those years. And then I went on into senior high, and that's when I met more children of color, and my whole perception of who I was started to change, and what I liked and all of these things. And then I went on to high school, and that was just a big identity crisis for me. And from there, I did graduate from high school and went on to college, which was at Carleton University in Ottawa. And I did struggle with who I was a lot of the time through school, and even out of school, trying to find out who I really was, where did I fit in, how could I identify myself. That's just the product of what this school system did for me. And, of course, again, it led me onto this decision to unschool.
What kind of support system do you have?
Honestly, I just have my husband, and he's the only advocate of what we are doing that I know. I explain what we're doing and our vision and things to a lot of people, and it sounds really good to them, very idealistic to them, but, you know, they still have their apprehension, and they're still concerned about, you know, well, don't you think they'd be better off doing this and that kind of thing? So honestly, it's just my husband. All the other family members around us are very concerned for our children, or not concerned at all enough, or, you know, to oppose what we're doing, but when it comes to support, I would just say it rests with my husband, because he and I are both like-minded in this. I don't find that there's a very big community here in Toronto. There's websites and those kind of things, but in terms of gatherings and support for parents, it seems to be very few and far between, and especially for Afrocentric or parents of color or however you'd like to identify yourself, I don't find that there's a lot of that out here. We just relocated here, actually, from the Broward County area in Florida, and there was the startup of a black home educators group, which was just incredible. And it really propelled me and encouraged me through this homeschooling journey. And it was, to come here was a big culture shock, just introducing myself to this society. But then again, to come as a homeschooler and then not to find this kind of support has kind of isolated us a little bit. So it's been, in that end of it has been, a bit of a struggle, but we've overcome that. I think the greatest challenge, honestly, is the lack of like-minded people, because there are many people who are homeschooling or unschooling, but yet they are still educating their children with the system in mind, but just in a different way. So, they still have the same reliance on the system, the way that the system structures itself based on what it uses to run itself. They're applying the same things to their homeschool, and I find that, that's disheartening, and I think that that's kind of a negative look on it. For us, unschooling completely means letting go of the system and completely letting go of it. What I'm trying to say is that we are trying to come back and center ourselves as to created beings on this earth. We were given this earth to live on. We were not asked to structure society in this way. This is the way we view it, and it's just taking away so much from our planet. And from the earth in itself, so much of the resources are being depleted, and the homeschoolers are contributing to this in the same way. They're trying to raise organic doctors and organic lawyers that will go back and still do this to the earth, that will still deplete it of its resources and is still depleted of all that we are supposed to be managing, and just trying to, give it a new name without really trying to restructure, the revolution of change that we're trying to bring about, which is peace and harmony with all created beings, animals, planets, water, everything in one. Because it's our children and it's the future. And if we were wise enough to be given this information, to have this path opened up to us, and for us to try to make these changes already 30 years into it, and then introduce our children completely into this lifestyle, maybe real change will come about, because they are the future. We take it to another level. We're not just looking at the education of our children to be viable members in this society, educated in a different way, but to truly make change that we want to see. I've seen demonstrations and protests and people actually trying to make vocal revolutions or stand up and say something out loud and it just be disregarded. So maybe we should try something else. From my experience, not too many people can hear. Everybody has ears, but not many people can actually hear. And so you can speak and somebody may not have internalized what you said. So in terms of the silent revolution, what I mean is mostly by action and by how you choose to live and what you choose to say no to. And that can be the example. I cannot change the whole nation all at once, but I can start by those who do have the ears to hear and those who have the eyes to see and who want to ask me, why are you doing it this way? Why are your children out of school? And then, I can take the time at that time. I have their attention. They have the interest. And I can spread the message that way. It's not going to happen in mass numbers. It's going to start one at a time. Just like in a marriage, in a relationship, it doesn't get good immediately. You have that great attraction at first that's so powerful, and you feel like you can overcome all things until, one day your child comes. Or you're married now, and one of you loses your job, and you don't know how the bills are going to get paid. You have to have that love and that commitment and that patience and that trust that didn't just happen in one instant. It took time to come. And this is the same thing. We've done so much damage over so many years. Now it's going to take so many to come back. But it's possible. So we don't use a curriculum. I think it's important that we, teach them to read and to write and those things, because so much knowledge is kept wrapped up in words. And I think it's important for my children to have that ability, of course. But when it comes to curriculum and those kind of things, I don't think they really serve a purpose for what we're trying to uncover. We spend a lot of our time outdoors. We are always in the valleys or in Florida. We're always at the beach and just touching it and being a part of it again. And it's a beautiful turn in my life. And I'm very grateful to have gotten this understanding at this point. I do counteract the negative things, images, and words, and ideas that are put out there about Africans and black people and multiculturalism. So I do counter those things with positivity. I'm not trying to spread hate or anything like that, but I am trying to encourage my children. So I fill our home with more images, more Afrocentric images, and just to encourage their idea of who they are, because it's so negative around them and it's so vast around them that I'm trying to give them this option here within the comfort of our home in terms of my culture and in terms of the color of my skin and the color of my children's skin and who we are. Then I fill them with majority of those things. I'm grateful to have this chance to voice something, because normally I keep to myself a lot. I really don't like to get caught up in too many things outside of what is best for myself and for my family and for the planet. But I'm very grateful to have this opportunity to say something. And I do hope that it will encourage any woman who thinks that she does not have the ability or doubts her abilities. Any woman, any man, any family that doesn't think they have what it takes to educate their child, that you have it. You've been given these children. You've been entrusted with them, with their well-being from conception all the way up until the time you or they die or whatever should happen in the course of your lives. But you are the most valuable teacher that your child could ever have.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free, and that's what the teacher said to me. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
I'm Noam Chomsky. You're listening to Radio Free School on CFMU 93.3.
The next part of the show I would like to dedicate to the memory of Tucker Gomberg, who took his own life March 3rd.
Took a bike ride yesterday, saw a funny world at play. Saw new bike lanes, honest streets, saw people and slowed down to greet green boxes next to blue and gray. Posters for a car-free day, saw families without a trace of fear and joy in public space. Little power in full sway, I saw things in a different way. Le monde à bicyclette. Le monde à bicyclette.
My name is Tucker Gomberg, and I'm here joining the procession for a healthier city, for a city where the priorities of people getting around is more important than the priorities of cars getting around. I just arrived in Hamilton, getting off the bus, and I'll tell you, not to be unfriendly or rude, but you get off the bus and it's a bus station. It's full of idling, belching diesel fumes, buses, idling, and then you get out of the bus station and it's just friend of mine once referred to this kind of situation as a nightmare of cars. I mean, look around here. It's just, you know, there's cars coming and going everywhere. I mean, if you're an elderly person trying to cross the street, it's no fun. If you're a person who's trying to breathe, it's not very healthy for you. And today's a beautiful spring day, and you know, if I could wave my magic wand and make these cars disappear, this would be a really beautiful scene here in downtown Hamilton. But, you know, we've got a city that's infested with cars. And in Toronto, something like 1,000 people die every year from the toxic air. I'm really keen to imagine and talk about and inspire people and conspire to transform our cities away from this car infestation, this dangerous situation, unpleasant situation, wasteful, unecological, unsocial situation, into one that's actually convivial and friendly and people-oriented and much more pleasant.
What do you think needs to be done in order to effect that kind of transformation?
Well, I hope somebody brought along a pickaxe today. Maybe we could do some depaving. You know what? Jane Jacobs said that we've lost our cities to the automobile bit by bit, piece by piece here and there, a road widening here, another parking lot there, a few more car parking spaces here and there. And, you know, my sense is that we really need to reclaim our cities for people in a similar fashion. I was in Copenhagen, Denmark, a few years back and was really inspired to see their approach, which is exactly that. Bit by bit, they're reclaiming the city, transforming their city into a place where space, which is at a premium in cities, is used for more valuable uses than just for parking cars or moving single-occupancy vehicles, the SOVs. So, you know, you look around, you say, well, geez, there must be better uses for all this space. We could be expanding the parks. We could have community gardens. We could have more affordable housing built. We could be transforming parking spaces into bicycle paths, into playgrounds. There's all kinds of other uses that we could be dedicating the space to. And I think we're in quite a quandary here. We've got so many people driving around, so many cars, and causing such local problems and a whole raft of local problems and global problems, you know, climate change and Exxon Valdez oil spills and holes in the ozone layer and so forth. I mean, it's all connected back to how we get around in our cities. And quite frankly, you know, today only, well, there's twice as many people on planet Earth getting around by bicycling, actually, today as getting around by car. But the people in China and India are aspiring to be driving just like we're driving. It seems to me the only way that we could say to them, don't make the same mistake we've made, is for us in our cities to enthusiastically embrace the alternative modes of transportation, cycling, walking, better urban design, public transit, and start moving away, putting a cap on the number of trips that happen by car in our society. And over the years, you know, over the next 10, 20 years, ratcheting down dramatically the number of trips that happen by car.
Tucker Gomburg never shied away from what had not been tried, with faithful friends there at his side. Showed us we could turn the tide on Adam's mind, and Kyoto would not go the way of the dodo. Burning passport declarations, buried car commemorations. Robin Hood through town he'd glide, inviting us along to ride. Mon bicyclette. Le monde à bicyclette.
Cities around the world are not car infested like we are here in North America. We kind of look around here in Hamilton and think, well, this is the way it's always been, you know, and will be forevermore. But the fact of the matter is, if you, you know, look, could travel backwards in time 100 years, you wouldn't see hardly any cars in Hamilton. If you traveled forward 100 years, I don't think we'll see many cars. If the agenda and if the goal is to have, you know, to be able to get around, to do our daily business, to go to the library, to pick up the groceries and the kids at daycare, if those are the things we want to do, then I would suggest one of the worst ways of doing it is by car. And we need to have a massive public debate on where it is we're going and what the true costs are, both financially and socially and ecologically, of this mode of transportation. Because, quite frankly, the planet cannot sustain everybody in India and everybody in China driving like we're driving. So what are we going to do about it? Well, I think we need to be encouraging. You know, I ride my bike everywhere and I love it. Studies have shown that, you know, the average motor vehicle driver is subsidized somewhere between $3,000 and $5,000, hidden subsidies, by everyone, for each car driver, something like $3,000 to $5,000. That's the subsidy. So when you look at it like that, you realize that it's actually cheaper for people to get around on transit than it is to subsidize them getting around by car. I think when people become aware of that, they'll start saying, hey, we want free public transit. We want the motorists to be paying to drive around. But interestingly, you don't hear that kind of argument very often in the corporate media. You know, I took the train out here, the GO train out, and I was picking up the corporate media. I don't usually buy it. I try to avoid it. But, you know, I picked up the Star, and there was a wheel section today in the Star. And it wasn't a wheel section. It was a car section. You know, I picked up the National Post, and there was also a wheel section. It wasn't a section about bicycling or about rollerblading. It was a section about driving. So the media are complicit in this mess, and we need to reclaim our media at the same time.
When the king of furniture decreed his actions immature, took aim at his crown and threw the people's gauntlet down, which some folks call buffoonery. How accurate they proved to be, for like the clowns of Yapery, his stock in trade was honesty. Sparking fires mirthfully to melt the ice of apathy in a moment at the secret. Le monde à bicyclette. Sometimes statistics only bore him, so he perforated dull decorum, energized the public forum. What else can one do but adore him? Ask yourself and make a list, and for a spell unclench your fist, for laughter is an activist. Look up now, see through the mist. Fiction like a lightning flash, dispensed with humor and panache, le monde à bicyclette. Le monde à bicyclette.
Let us move to action. In the hallways of power, we must tell the truth. The costs of all this automobility are much too high, in human terms, in dollar terms. In 1997 alone, the cost in Toronto of car crashes was between $2.5 and $3 billion. Billion dollars. $3 billion would build a lot of bike paths. $3 billion would put a lot more streetcars on the roads. $3 billion could put our transportation system, a healthy, sustainable transportation system, on track. But warning is not enough. We must move our hands to action, or else the bloody carnage will continue. When there is talk of widening a highway to make it safer, let us reply. Cars mixed with speed, booze, and cell phones are unsafe. We all care about saving lives and money. Those funds should instead be invested in safe and rapid train service. Today, every second, a new car rolls off an assembly line somewhere on planet Earth. Every second. This is a population crisis of cars that is out of control. Humans have filled North America, Europe, and Australia with cars. And now the car companies are moving into the less industrialized countries to do the same. China, India, and most of the world today still gets around by foot and by bicycle. Unless we talk about and organize to stop them, to stop Ford, to stop Exxon, to stop Imperial Oil from moving into those countries, they too will turn into gridlock, grizzly Gehennas. But let us not be somber. We can break this addiction with willpower and with spirit. Amsterdam has voted to remove half the parking spaces from its center. Copenhagen transforms parking lots into parks, and road space into extensive bike space. Curitiba, Brazil has built an extensive transit network at very low cost. Around the world, groups are organizing to reclaim the streets and reclaim their cities with parties that celebrate the streets without Toyotas and without Subarus. The great gift of the human species is our minds. Our minds have two notable aspects. We can imagine and we can alter our environment. Today, we're on the cusp of killing the planet for our convenience. Can we find ways to spice up our imaginations and tap into our yearning for clean air and a livable city? Can we inspire ourselves and our politicians to end the carnage and rebuild our city so that cars are hardly necessary, so that neighborhoods are accessible by healthier means of travel? Of course we can. We can evolve Hamilton into a place where people and nature, not asphalt and poison, come first. We can do it if we will it. Thank you.
I only saw him a couple times in person where the tower chimes, raging at the climate crimes, with horns a-honking, words in rhyme, were juggling by a tent for peace. In frozen winter, without cease, we wish for him eternal laughter, peace of mind in the hereafter. Inspiring him as he does we, may we all forever see a more happy seaplane. Le monde habite si clair. Le monde habite si
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Take one.
Traveling around from land.
Tucker was an inspiration to me, his activism rooted as it was in hope. His sense of humor, his dramatic flair for action, his consistent living out the dream of a better world made him a major force wherever he went. In an article he wrote about activism, Tucker found inspiration in Henry David Thoreau's timeless essay on the duty of civil disobedience. Thoreau wrote, "Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine." Tucker answered, "I take this as a license, indeed a duty, to push harder, to take chances, to be bold, to cross the line." He certainly, without fail, gave it his all. Tucker's death is, of course, a tragic loss for those who knew and loved him, but patient, abused Mother Earth has lost herself a dedicated son. For that, we should all mourn. May his spirit live on.
Oh, yes, our delicious soul.